exciting episode of National Bugle Radio on the Republic Broadcasting Network, RBN, Free Speech Central. Go to republicbroadcasting.org and donate to keep this station afloat. And also go to nationalbugle.com and click on the co-certified button and download the co-certified app so that we can all lead a non-kosher certified lifestyle. Today I have a very special guest, somebody that RBN listeners will probably be familiar with. We have Pastor James David Manning. Welcome back to RBN, Pastor Manning.
Well, it's good to be back. I'm glad to be on the, back on the sound waves here today.
Okay, you were on the Dr. Duke show, David Duke show, about a month ago or so, and it was an interesting show, and I thought, wow, I'd love to have you on my show, and, you know, there's all sorts of things we could talk about, and, you know, you've got, I could do it as an interview. You're an interesting person in your own right, but I thought, you're always hearing about, oh, we need, in this country, we need a conversation on race, and I don't think I've ever heard a conversation on race. I've heard a lot of lecturing to white people from, say, from Jews, or from other non-whites, or from non-Jewish whites, a lot of lecturing. I've never actually heard a conversation. I thought it might be interesting to see what a conversation might sound like, and I think you sound like a very reasonable person. I hope I'm a reasonable person, so we could see what that's like. But before we get into that, for those listeners who aren't familiar with you, maybe you could just give a brief introduction of yourself.
Well, yeah, I'm a pastor of a church for 37 years, and the church I'm the pastor of is in Harlem, New York City, the flagship of the so-called African-American community. I enjoy the work that I do. I probably was on RBN some time ago, as many as 10, 12 years ago. I made a very public statement about why I thought that Barack Hussein, the long-legged MacDaddy Obama, was not qualified constitutionally to be president. That he wasn't some sort of a black messiah, as many black folk worshipped him to be. I simply spoke that truth, and as a result of that, a large number of, I don't know whether you call them conservative outlets, media outlets and others, sought to hear what I had to say on that, in that regard. But I was born and raised in North Carolina. One of the things that Dr. Duke observed about me is that I still have that a bit of that country folksy style about me. Is just hard to get rid of because I grew up around all my uncles and everybody talking, and black and white people talking in a similar fashion. But I've been in New York, and I got waylaid back in the late 60s, early 70s. So I grew up in North Carolina, though I grew up Jim Crow in the South, and deep in North Carolina, near the South Carolina border. I didn't grow up with racial hatred, and a lot of people find that hard to believe. They just don't believe it. But I didn't. I mean, you know, Jim Crow was there, and I graduated from a segregated high school. But when I came to New York and came north, and, about a decade later, I was taught racism, I was taught hatred, and it ended up I ended up in prison as a result of, for the most part. It's a long way of saying that's what took place. But, you know, I've been preaching, and I'm here in Harlem, and God's allowed me to survive, the Obama worshiper, and a lot of the civil rights worshiping as well. That's a little bit about who I am. I don't know how much more detail I probably need to give.
Well, I think that's fine for now. Let's start off. So we've got white people and black people in this country. Now we've got a lot of other people as well. When we were kids, it was mostly white people and then a lot of black people also. And you could go back 400 years and, you know, of course there were American Indians in large parts of the country, but the American society was white people, majority black people, minority, and that pretty much summed it up, and we've been around for 400 years. And we've gone through different stages of history, and, you know, there was obviously the slavery, long slavery era, there was a post-slavery era, you mentioned Jim Crow, the civil rights movement, and here we are today. So So, are we at the promised land yet?
Hell no. I don't know if I know your audience well enough to say that. But no, we're not at the promised land at all. We are far from it. I think we're moving further away from what potentially could be a promised land. And we're more in a land of, I think we're facing perhaps a greater sense of adversity and war than we are any sort of a utopian promised land among people. And you're right about the demographics of America. Going back the last 70 years or so, and then from there, the foundation of America was mainly just black people and white people. Now, immigration has brought, obviously, a lot of other people into America, a ton of other kindreds and tongues. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, black people were about a 7 to 10% populace, let's say post-slavery, Jim Crow Reconstruction period. But we are far from a problem. I just did a piece today myself, as today represents the anniversary of the Martin King March on Washington, the 28th of August, 1963, and pointed out that we are worse off today. Now, a lot of people get upset with me about this, but we're worse off today than we were before that march. Before that march, though Jim Crow existed and other things, black people in general were a more spiritual people. They were more morally correct. They were ethically proud of themselves. And they were an independent people who nurtured their families, and men were in the homes prior to that march, and then after that, the Civil Rights Movement of 1964. So to answer your question regarding, are we in the promised land, quite frankly, and anybody's who's willing to have to speak the truth, black people, and then of course the resultant of that, black people being worse, you're going to find more adversity between black people and white people. Mm-hmm. The tensions are growing greater now than they were even then.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I went to school, public schools that were newly desegregated, and sometimes I was in majority black schools, sometimes I was in majority white schools, and it wasn't all rosy. My brother, who had started out at a before desegregation, said, "Well, you know, we used to all be friends, but you know, in my first grade class, second grade class, we were still pretty much all friends, blacks and whites, maybe because." I don't know, because the riots hadn't started yet, and maybe younger kids haven't developed away from each other as much yet. But you know, there were at the same time there were differences. And one thing I do remember though is you could say mommy and daddy, and everybody had a mommy and a daddy, and
right.
That and sometimes I say it seems as if that black people have traded a father in the home for Obama in the White House. That's what I used to say. And I don't think that's necessarily a very good deal.
Yeah.
So speaking as a white person in the current year, 2019, through the media and through the education system, if you look at history textbooks in public schools, it seems like there's a very, very... This is my interpretation, the interpretation of a lot of other white people. It seems very, very anti-white that there's this massive emphasis on slavery, on Jim Crow, on the Holocaust, on colonialism, and in all of the narratives, white people are the bad guy. And then, you know, if you watch TV, you'll see TV commercials, and very often white people are portrayed as fat and stupid, and it might seem petty, but it's just on and on and on. And so then you look around, and I look at some of the websites and listen to the podcasts of the younger white people, and there is a kind of a backlash. And so, they're using all sorts of expletives, whether they're speaking about Jews or various foreigners or blacks. You know, they use the N-word frequently, It seems like there's a big backlash. And then amongst people who maybe aren't as unsensitive, you still have the backlash. I think Trump is the product of a white backlash. Maybe white people not knowing what exactly is wrong or why it's wrong or how it got to be this way, but just knowing something's wrong.
Well, I think that one of the things that was dominant in social teaching during the time of the transitioning of the Jim Crow civil rights period was that the history books did not include black history in terms of the local county state school structure. That was primarily white history. So probably, and in fact not probably, but I'm confident what you're experiencing now in both in media, in movies, and in the education system now is an attempt to bring black history to the forefront, or the history, and mainly black history, but it's done in a way as to make the dominant white race the evil. For the slavery issue, that's number one in terms of its thesis and foundation, but also the fact that black history was not a part of the process. And then the other thing I think is that there's a lot of commercialism, commercializing of the races, of what sells. You know, if you can portray the white man as being an awful person and having done things to black people, it sells in the movies. Then, of course, there's the other aspect of that. Of course, if you the well-founded movie, The Birth of a Nation, that also sells. So the fact that our education system and the entertainment system working hand in hand usually are not necessarily out to promote the truth. They'll take a smithering of the truth, and then they will use it to promote business interest in terms. And I think that has been quite detrimental to both races. It has raised the level of tensions against the potential of white and black folk working together, or at least understanding each other's position. Mm-hmm. And while at the same time, it has created a chasm that continues to grow. When Obama was Obama ran for president, you said that black people gave up daddies in the home for Obama. You know, I like that as a phrase, but I have to tell you, they gave up daddies in the home
a lot earlier than that. Yeah,
but they're very much satisfied with that. You know, but one of the things that got me in a lot of trouble was, I stated that Obama was not some sort of a messiah or panacea or utopia where he was going to solve the problems of black people. I watch these movies and the education, they never tell the black man the truth about his failings in many, many ways. There is some good things that can be said, and I can say them. Mm-hmm. But there are a large number of failings that I think that have just whitewashed or not been told. And so therefore one can argue, well, white folk did not put black history in the history books. But I think that if a lot of black history was told the appropriate way, at least it would demonstrate that there's a lot to be desired that has not happened and has created problems, if you understand where I'm going with that.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And hopefully we'll get deeper into that. This is a conversation on race, and I think to understand what's going on racially in the United States now, and this is really what Dr. Duke was trying to emphasize in when you were on his show, and I'm often speaking to foreigners who are trying to understand what's going on in the United States, because even if they recognize they recognize that America is letting in all of these people from all over the world, and it's completely changing the demographics. Blacks are no longer the number one minority. You know, they were the minority, the only significant minority in the United States, and now Hispanics have passed up blacks. And, of course, whites are headed towards minority status themselves, so you have a no majority in the country. And to just let in all of these people from outside is something that gets a lot of people's heads scratching. And then, looking at what's going on in the culture and the anti-white narratives, to the extent that, say, somebody from overseas perceives it, it's like, why? America, you still got a white president, mostly white Congress. Why are white people doing this to themselves? And what Dr. Duke was trying to emphasize, and what I completely agree with. It's the only way you can understand this is to understand Jewish power. And while Jews might have white skin, I'm a political scientist, and their political behavior, politically, they behave in a way that is diametrically opposed to the interest of the non-Jewish white majority. And so then when you start isolating Jewish behavior and then looking at Jewish power within the United States, you see that, oh, well, there would not have been mass immigration into the United States had it not been for this Jewish domination of our society. You probably wouldn't have had, you might have had some sort of civil rights movement of some sort, but it might have been very different. It might have been much more of a, his name slipped. How can his name slip my mind? You know who I'm talking about, the leader in the 1920s.
Garvey. You're absolutely right. Mm-hmm. I'm trying to think of the name of the person as well.
Garvey.
Marcus Garvey, yeah. And I talked with Dr. Duke about that offline. We didn't get to it, and I want to get to it online, but we only had a brief amount of time.
He talked too much. I love Dr. Duke, but sometimes he gets excited and talks too much.
But I was, you know, it was just good to talk to him, and he has some things he wanted to say. But let me say this to you. You're right about the demise of the white race in terms of its population dominance in America today, which is fueling Trump's presidency, because it's a reality. This is not some sort of theological, philosophical, you know, economic ideology. It is a reality that the dominance is happening in ways in which it's happening so rapidly, most people aren't able to adjust to it. And the other problem is that you've got liberal whites who will not join with allegedly conservative whites or southern whites to make up a majority. Mm-hmm. But, you know, there's a fellow who's a part of our ministry. I guess I consider him a part of our church. He's been with us now for several years. When I talk about Mexicans, or I talk about, well, first of all, Latinos, Hispanics, they are rated on the social register about 5 to 7 percentiles higher socially than the indigenous black people. And then, of course, Raphael points out as well that Mexicans do not have a good relationship with black people at all. In fact, they find themselves they think themselves as being far superior. Mm-hmm. There are several arguments that can be made, but I think that what's happening in America, there's no doubt about it. There's a shift in demographics, and it's a major shift in population, and so therefore, it's going to affect the economics, it's going to affect the political structure and political ability. And what is happening with Trump right now I know he doesn't care anything about it, but at least he represents that. But if I can go back to Marcus Garvey in just a moment. Mm-hmm. You know, Marcus Garvey was a separatist. He wasn't a segregationist. He wasn't an integrationist.
Right.
Marcus Garvey's, you know, his position ultimately, while he's powerful here in Harlem in terms of independence, but ultimately his goal was to move black people back to Africa. Mm-hmm. That's not taught a lot, mm-hmm. but that's ultimately what he wanted to do. And one of the reasons he was court-martialed and thrown back to Jamaica is because he had purchased several major steamships
right.
that formed the Marcus Garvey steamship
line. Black Star Line, right?
Yeah.
And isn't the Black Star the flag of Ghana? Isn't that
is at present, yeah.
Okay.
But go ahead, you want to say something about
that? No, I was just going to say that I think that Ghana put the Black Star on their flag because of that Black Star line.
Yeah. Ultimately, that was, at the time, we're talking the area just north of during the Depression and north of the Depression, would have affected the economy of America. You have to think about this in that regard, because if Garvey had been successful in transporting blacks back to something that James Monroe did back mm-hmm. in the Monroe, by sending people back, and they formed Liberia, if you'll remember, mm-hmm. gave them ships and money and a bunch of other things to start the colony in Liberia. But that would have greatly affected the economy if blacks had been all of a sudden gotten on boats and gone back to Africa. The white economy or the economy at the time would have been greatly affected by it. So they stopped that.
We'll be right back. And we are back. Let's hear more of that interview with Reverend Manning.
The white economy, or the economy at the time, would have been greatly affected by it. So they stopped that. What we see now happening now is the economy being affected in an adverse way by the immigration process. Mm-hmm. So I think that David Duke was right. We talked about this offline. That and David Duke is primarily believes that white people should live with white folk, and that black folks should live with black folk. That there should that the races are not necessarily homogeneous in their makeup and their culture and their nature. You might also remember that Elijah Muhammad, who the leader or founder of the Nation of Islam, a preacher born down in Georgia, also asked the American government back in the 50s or 60s for the state of Alabama. So all the black people could move away from white folk and mm-hmm. they could live separately independently. I'm not sure that you're aware of that, but that has been a thesis for some time.
Mm-hmm. Well, if you look around the world where you've got, say, a minority in a particular country, the movements, the political movements among that minority tend to be for separatism. You know, and you can look at the recent examples in the Soviet Union and Yugoslavia. So it wasn't that the Latvians or the Uzbekis were trying to integrate into the Russians. They wanted to be separate and have a separate homeland. And then you look historically, and perhaps the colonization movement headed by President Monroe and others, in fact supported by President Lincoln, that might have been something that was realistic in the 1800s. Maybe it would have had a good result. It may have still been realistic when Marcus Garvey was attempting it. But of course, now you've got the idea of 40 million black Americans suddenly being transported to what's become a very crowded Africa, what is now a very crowded Africa. I think it's pretty unrealistic, right?
Yeah, well, he thought it would work. People were excited about it.
But, they might have worked 100 years ago.
If I ever get a chance to talk to David Duke again, I want to ask him, and it would have to be in context of what's happened. If you go to Europe now, you're talking, Europe has a greater influx of immigration problem. And if you're talking Germany and the UK, and to some degree Spain, they've got a greater issue with immigration than America does. And the question I would want to ask Dr. Duke, says he's a doctorate of history, that what we see in terms of Brexit, and I don't want to get too far afield about our conversation. Mm-hmm. I'm just musing on what I would ask him, what he thought about the fact of what's happening in Europe, because immigration is becoming, the white populace is being threatened both in Europe and in America.
Mm-hmm.
And the response to that, I'm not sure what's going to be the best answer to that. I'd like to ask him what he thinks about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know that he's very alarmed at the massive immigration into Europe from non-European countries. And, you know, that's something that we talk about an awful lot on this show. It's something that's of great interest to, you know, our listeners to... you know, even though, well, that's Europe and this is the United States, but I have every Monday a Englishman who joins me, and we talk about these issues. And, you know, we see a lot of the same things happening on both sides of the Atlantic. And we believe that it's, in both cases, it has to do with Jewish domination of politics, which is a little more obvious in the United States, but it's still prevalent over there. Okay, so... there's a couple of things I want to ask. Maybe I'll start with this. So, in instilling white guilt, in fostering white guilt in the United States, through textbooks, through movies, popular culture, whatnot, probably slavery, almost certainly slavery is the big issue. That's the big original sin of America, and you know. We can look and say, "Oh, well, slavery is absolutely an evil," but of course, it's been throughout history. It certainly hasn't been limited to the United States. It's been throughout history, throughout the world. You see lots of mentions of slavery in the Bible, for instance. So it's there. A point I would like to make is, well, okay, if you compare the lives of black slaves in the United States to, say, the free whites who were living in the southern, in the, you know, well, nearby, mostly in the right. southern states. There was slavery in the north to an extent as well. Or especially if you compare the lives of the black slaves to the white farmers in the north. The lives of black slaves were considerably worse. The white farmers, especially in the north, they were pretty affluent. Maybe you could have a chip on your shoulder that way. But if you think of agricultural workers in the 16, 17, 1800s, the era that we're talking about, around the world, and you look at the conditions in India or Africa or China or Europe, the conditions of agricultural workers, they may be peasants, they may be serfs, they may be slaves, in general, is really bad. Agricultural workers throughout history, if they lived long enough to reproduce, that was pretty good. And so by certain measures, if you look at you had 400,000 blacks who were transported across the Atlantic into North America. And by the Civil War, that they had multiplied tenfold to 4 million, and of course now another tenfold to 40 million. But to have that kind of... So by in terms of their reproductive success, if you compare them to pretty much agricultural workers pretty much anywhere around the world, they were more successful. And then also, if you look at the... pull up Wikipedia and you look at a list of famines around the world.
And we will be right back.
You are tuned in to the Republic Broadcasting Network. Visit our website by going to republicbroadcasting.org.
Without the right accessories, any guy can be off the mark. Whether you've invested thousands in your arsenal or you own a single trusted firearm, a visit to aroutfitting.com is in order. It's one of the finest online selections of tactical optics and AR parts and add-ons, like EOTech, quick target acquisition with no peripheral loss. Browse the full range of Nikon scopes and binoculars. AirOutfitting.com can illuminate your world with Streamlight gun-mounted lights from keychain to large handhelds up to 1,100 lumens. Find some stability with Battenfield tactical bipods. AirOutfitting.com has CMMG gun parts, barrels, assemblies, handguards, part kits, and more. Plus Magpul clips and magazines. I know I've got you excited, so take a breath. Head to AirOutfitting.com. The site's super easy to navigate and features a ton of technical info, including links to manuals. We also welcome vendor and manufacturer inquiries. Remember, if you don't see it, we can get it at AirOutfitting.com.
It happens more often than we can imagine. In my case, I was sitting at home, and out of nowhere, I just started feeling uncomfortable. Then it got worse, and I started perspiring. I tried to ignore it, but I waited too long. The chest pain came as we were driving to the hospital emergency. I felt my life clock begin to tick. I barely survived. There was lots of damage done to my heart. What do I do now? I was lucky. I took a leap of faith and tried a 7-herb formula with hawthorn, garlic, cayenne, and more called Extendivite. Herbs have been used for thousands of years to keep us healthy. If you're not using Extendivite as a preventative supplement, maybe it's time to start. To order, call 1-877-928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with Extendivite.
Tired of being lied to by mass media? It's growing more and more apparent today that news is received less and less through standard media outlets. Even with a growing audience every day, RBN is beginning to direct more efforts into social media. Social media and the use of the internet is fast becoming the primary source of people for news, regardless of demographic. RBN has set out to provide some of the best news on the internet through republicbroadcasting.org and also has begun to use the tools to our advantage by way of social media. Republic Broadcasting is now operating a Facebook page to function as yet another avenue to have our collective voice reach new audiences across not only America, but across the globe as well. The Facebook page features not only news, but also an RBN player to listen to our broadcast. Get involved by visiting facebook.com/republicbroadcasting and liking our page and share it with your friends and family, because you can handle the truth.
And then also, if you look at the, pull up, you know, Wikipedia, and you look at a list of famines around the world, you'll see that during the 16th, 17th, 1800s, you had famines constantly all over the world, Europe too, but not in America. You never had that. So,
why do you think that is? That's interesting. I never heard that
question. I don't know.
Why do you think that is? And I want to respond to the slavery issue and the biblical aspect of that. But
okay.
I don't want to lose that. Why do you think that is that America has not suffered famine the way, you know, other European nations have?
Well, it may be because of a relatively low population on a large and fertile, sparsely populated new continent. That might have a lot to do with it, and also it might have to do with advances in technology or other things.
But it wasn't very much technology back in the 17th, 18th century. I mean, you know, there was some mechanism of plows or maybe, you know, but basically everything was, you know, until Eli Whitney invented the cotton gin, that still had to be seeded out by hand. But you know what I thought? I was trying to lead you in, I thought maybe one would argue maybe God just blessed America, you know, where Ireland was not as well blessed with a potato famine.
Right, big famine there.
And you know that because America was blessed and did not suffer famines and other ravages, people from all over Europe poured into America, into Ellis Island. I don't want to get too far afield on that, but I thought it was a very interesting dynamic you raised, and I wanted to make a mention. Can I say also a word about biblical slavery?
Please do.
The Bible does endorse it. You can't get around it. It's there. I think that, and I've said this for years, I read it in the Bible. Read it in the Bible. The Bible endorses it. I believe the Word of God. You know, I don't necessarily have to understand everything or like everything, but if God said it, if it's in God's Word, then I'm not going to be against it. I'm not going to think that somehow or another God made a mistake. And you know, something more significant than in the Bible, even with slavery, if you look at the three generations of Noah's son, Shem, the Jewish group, Japheth, the white group, and Ham, the black group, Ham was assigned through Noah to serve Shem and Japheth. There's no getting around that. And then you have to look at what God did with Jacob and sending him down to Egypt for 400 years for slavery. But I think the problem is when you say the word slavery, all kinds of evil, dark, and ugly spirits arise, mainly because of the brutality that have been associated with it and the way in which it's deployed. But it's a biblical principle, and I think to be true to God, you've got to accept it as a biblical principle. And you cannot deny it as an essence of what, as how humanity developed. You just can't. If you do, then you're going to have to find a way to demonize people, which I think is what has happened, and what continues to happen. And then one other thing is that you look at America as an agricultural, agrarian type of a society, and we were for many, many years. We were as such, and until we moved out of the agricultural agrarian society into an industrial age, we didn't become a world power until the 19th century when we moved beyond agriculture. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I'm of the mindset of believing that America prospered because God blessed us. But one other thing, because I know our time is limited, you know, to have a conversation on race, the patterns for us been that for race has been set, and you state that the Jews who own much of the media that dominates what can be said. Listen, you know, if Al Sharpton displeased Jews in any way, he wouldn't be on television.
Mm-hmm.
If Obama displeased Jews or Wall Street in any way, he would have never been president.
Mm.
The problem is that when, and I don't say that in a way that's mean-spirited, I'm just pointing up the fact that they're not going to let a person like me come on television, or you, and hold a debate on race, because we're not going to kowtow or bow down to the powers that be, and that's the problem. So when you hear whatever dialogue that goes on these talk show programs, it's already bought and paid for, and they're only going to go to certain limits. They're not going to dig. They're not going to point fingers and not going to deal with the truth. So that is a major problem. It's a problem that is genociding both races. It's a problem that's genociding America. Because you got a bald, you got actor. Sharpton, Sharpton is an actor. He's the, he come, they call him an activist. And all these other civil rights people, whoever the hell they think they are, they're all actors. They're all actors, not actors. They're not going to let David Duke on television. I can tell you that right now. They made a movie about him.
I saw the movie.
Yeah, I saw the movie too. But they ain't going to let him on television. They're not. Now, they'll let Al Sharpton on, who in many ways can, if you want to talk about a type of language or so, or racial or social statements, which can be quite thought-provoking. Al has been that. But they're just not going to let, until the media decides that they're going to open up a race conversation by people who are articulate enough, who are educated enough, who is passionate and truthful enough to tell the truth, they ain't going to let that happen. So, you know, whether it's the Jews that's running the media right now and running Wall Street, they're the one that's telling us what to, telling us what to think about race and believe. Except for me, they don't tell me what to think or what the hell to do either.
Mm-hmm. Okay, now, in our current atmosphere, in the current election, we're hearing a lot about, for instance, reparations for slavery. So this whole legacy of slavery. So there was slavery. And, you know, you can certainly emphasize the evils or the brutalities of slavery. But, you know, you can also do the comparison with, well, the life of an American slave compared to an Irish or Indian or Chinese peasant or serf or whatever, or an industrial worker. Because actually some of the industrial workers, you look at the industrial workers in the 1800s in Britain, and they had absolutely horrible lives. So if for a black person today to look back at slavery, I mean, should they have a chip on their shoulder, or should they say, well, as a result of you know, my ancestors toiling in the fields, I have full citizenship in a very affluent country, much more affluent than basically, you know, anywhere else that I might wind up, you know, could have wound up living, anywhere else in the world. So how would you think black people should feel about history?
I think that reparations is one issue. It's an issue that could probably, that will come out of slavery. And slavery is another issue of its own. I've always been against reparations. Let me say at the outset, until recently, what's happened here in Harlem, the community of Harlem, by banksters, by bankers, by predatory lending, a large number of liberal and mainly LGBTQ white folk have moved into Harlem and have taken over the joint.
Wow.
You know, they got the money to be able to do it. And they've taken literally billions of dollars worth of property and income away from what I refer to as the indigenous people of the community. And my statements were pretty much a provocative statements that reparations should be paid to the indigenous people of Harlem for the loss of their property here in Harlem. That's one statement. And it doesn't necessarily mean reparations in terms of a total social movement. I've always been against reparations as a way of solving the problem of slavery. I would think, I could bet my seat in heaven on this one, that reparations would only further destroy the potential of the black persons. The same way I believe that a so-called black president destroyed the sense of independence and a moral work ethic, believing that, and also the family structure, believing that Obama was the answer. When I look at reparations, I look at it the same way as that Obama was not, if you thought Obama's going to be payment for slavery or for blackness or whatever else you want to say between the races, that was definitely not the case. In fact, he was a destructive force. So in many ways, you know, you start handing out money to black folk, easy come if it hasn't been earned. And I mean, if you gave somebody 40 acres and a mule years ago, that might have worked.
Mm-hmm.
But to give somebody in Chicago, give a teenage boy in Chicago, or his father who's a teenager in mind, but he's 50 years of age, you know, $40,000, he's going to kill himself. He's going to kill himself. And the money has a value based on the way it is earned. Now, you're right. The working conditions in Europe going back in the 18th century, 17th and 18th century, they were horrible. Long days, 12 hours a day, 12, 7 days a week, they were right. But I think the separation there is that they were not slaves. They had the opportunity to go home at night. That makes it. I would want to point out that difference.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, of course. The one thing that actually might have helped the black slaves in America with food security was the fact that they were property, and that for them to starve to death would be a loss of asset for the owner. You'll see that sometimes. When things got tough for the factory owner in Birmingham, England, he could just fire his workers, and if they died, so what? When things got better, he could hire new ones. But
can I say one other word about the reparations idea? And this is not, you don't hear this, but this needs to be told. You know, at the end of slavery, in the Reconstruction period, many blacks owned large swaths of land from East Texas over to Florida, from Florida north to Maryland and in Ohio. And in fact, I grew up around blacks who have their own land. My wife, whose mother and father comes from Tidewater area in North Carolina, up near the south border of Virginia, still own large parts of land. I mean, farmland that was owned. And this land was transferred through, not necessarily through the 40 acres and a mule, but it happened as a result of what was a genuine spirit. It was on this land that black colleges were built. It was on this land that black churches flourished, black schools flourished. On land, there were blacks, my friend, that owned 300 or 400 acres of land. That's mm-hmm. You were a rich man mm-hmm. if you owned that kind of land. What has happened to that? Where did that go? It's all been squandered away. When we left the sense of understanding and independence, the hard work and the labor that is required for the maintenance of that land. And that's not reported in the history books, and I never hear anybody talking about that when they do have a race relations program, that when blacks were given large swaths of land, and they did own it, they squandered it away. So that needs to be said as well.
Mm-hmm. And I'm just going to make the point, because this is a conversation, I actually had been in favor of reparations once upon a time. I read a book by Randall Robinson. Maybe you're familiar with him.
I am.
Yeah.
I am familiar with him.
And it was actually, pretty well laid out argument. And I thought, wow, okay, he's made a good case. Although in more recent years, I've looked at, economic data of the spending on Medicaid and food stamps and public schools and, a variety of programs, more recently Obamacare, and also looked at tax rates and tax brackets. And I see that there has been a large transfer of financial assets over the past 50, 60 years from, largely, predominantly white taxpayers to disproportionately black recipients of certain programs to the tune of at least a couple $1 trillion. Over the course of 50, 60 years.
A correction. $1 trillion a year. We're talking $30 trillion.
Okay.
I know what you're talking about.
Okay, well, thank you. Thank you for correcting me. You're probably more on top of it than I am.
$1 trillion a year. When you add up all the programs, since Lyndon Johnson's Civil Rights Act and the equal opportunity, equal banking, equal housing, equal education, equal, it has cumulative come to $1 trillion a year.
Okay.
I don't want to just kind of push it around, but that's been $1 trillion a year, not just one or two. That's a lot of money that has gone into one segment of people over a period of 30 or so years.
And so then you would agree that reparations are not in order?
Well, that's why I say it would be absolutely.
Right. Okay.
Absolutely. Because if that amount of money has been poured into the community and it has not benefited the community, in fact, it has made the community a worse group of people, then reparations would be a blatant and open attack upon what could be independence.
Mm-hmm.
But, for 3 years, I went over that information. I looked at what has happened since all the equal legislation that was passed by Alan Clayton Powell. And I can assure you, and your listeners as well, $1 trillion per year to what at one time been about 27 million, which has grown, you say it's 40 million blacks in America, I think it's more like 35 to 36 million presently in America now, and half of them in Kill in Chicago. But But $1 trillion a year to sustain the education process, to sustain the medical programs, which is necessary, mm-hmm. but to sustain families as well. And my argument 4 or 5 years ago was this, that if that $1 trillion a year poured into the black communities, into the ghettos, for housing, for education, for child care, for teaching children how to put a diaper on a baby, for substance of rent subsidies, if the black man had to earn that money by the sweat of his brow, because if the white taxpayer had it out there to pay, then the money is available. Economically, the money was in the system. It wasn't that there was no money in the system like in Ghana or in Nairobi or Nigeria, that the money is not in the system. The $1 trillion a year was in the system. So if the black husband and father had earned that money rather than given to him, it would have had a totally different effect. That was my argument many years. I don't argue that very much anymore. But that was my argument then. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so we only have maybe six minutes or so left. I want to get into maybe what's the real question. So we're not at the promised land now. And maybe the society you were born into, North Carolina under Jim Crow, maybe it wasn't the promised land either, although there are certain things you could say. You probably had a black commercial class in your town. There was a NPR reporter from Chicago who maybe 10 years ago decided he's a black guy, and decided he was just going to, for a year, only buy from black businesses. Well, he couldn't do it because they don't exist anymore, not in Chicago at least. There weren't enough. He couldn't get the things he needed. And that probably wouldn't have been the case 50 years ago. Now, you know, separation might not be realistic. Forced integration, how well has that worked? Is there something in between? How do you think, you know, because here we are, whites and blacks in this big country, what can we do to either get along better or avoid each other more or what? What do you think?
You know, I don't want to be short on the answer. I appreciate also you bringing up the buy black idea, which was a large part of what made a lot of people wealthy in Chicago going back 50, 60 years ago. You can't do that now because black people don't own a pot nor a window to throw it out of. Here's my position, and it's greatly misunderstood. I think black people owe America rather than America owe black people. I think, and I call them Hamites, but for the you know, spirit of our conversation today, I'll use the term black. I'll continue to use it. Black people owe America. America doesn't owe black people anything, not even as a result of slavery.
Please stay tuned for the rest of this interview.
Homeowners, are you in foreclosure, expecting to be served with a foreclosure lawsuit, or suspect your lender has coerced you into an illegal mortgage transaction? A huge number of mortgages made in the last 10 years have legal issues and are possibly defective. State laws and the U.S. Supreme Court have upheld that defective mortgage documents are grounds for foreclosure defense and for counterclaims in favor of the homeowner. If your mortgage has been sold or assigned since closing the loan, it may be defective and you may be paying the wrong party, and the lender may not have standing or the right to foreclose or collect payments under the law. If you would like to know if your mortgage is legal or not, or know if you are paying the right party, we can help. Our initial consultations are free of charge. We are not attorneys. We are legal researchers and work closely with experienced lawyers who know how to help you find the evidence to help you keep your home. Call toll free 1-855-2-KEEP-IT. That's 1-855-2-KEEP-IT today.
Many people write us about their experience with Extendivite. Allow me to read you some from Amazon.com. It really does work like the review says it does. I cannot believe that after the first few days, I didn't feel as sluggish or clogged up. It has had a profound impact on my physical, emotional well-being. I'm skeptical as most people about products and their claims, and I never write reviews, but this is a wonderful product and I recommend it to everyone. Great product. It has brought my blood pressure from the mid-150s over the 80s to the mid-130s over mid-80s. Along with diet and exercise in just the past couple of months. Excellent. Thank you, David. Tell us your story. Get Extendivite today. Call 1-877-919-3663.
928-8822 or visit heartdrop.com.
Extend your life with ExtendoVite.
Hey gang, Patrick Slattery here with an important message that is pertinent to anyone who shops for groceries, eats food, or just has an inquisitive mind like myself. What I'm about to introduce you to is a segment of our food culture that has been kept so low profile to the American public that virtually no one is aware of how dominant it is on our refrigerator and cupboard shelves. What I'm talking about is the kosher certification industry and a new app, Koshertify, that delivers a comprehensive education on all aspects regarding this little-known practice. After reviewing this app, I found that it is useful for practically anyone who purchases food, regardless of their religious faith or identity. Its database of products not kosher certified is a win-win convenience for all food-conscious people. So why not check out thekosherquestion.com or click on the link at nationalbugle.com and see how modifying your grocery shopping with the Koshertified app can make a huge difference for your future.
Black people owe America. America doesn't owe black people anything, not even as a result of slavery. I believe that there is an inherent, first of all, self-hatred that black people have for themselves. They have their own class system. There was an economic class during the Jim Crow period of black people who had wealth and others who did not. My position is this: while there's no race that's perfect, and white folks sure have a lot to do on their own, mm-hmm. but I think in terms of race relations, black people have made America a more difficult place in terms of the behavior, their level of understanding. And they weren't always that way, mind you. But I think if the argument was turned rather than white folk owing black folk, which is what the narrative is, and whether it's promoted by Jews or the media or the education system, if the narrative was turned that black folk owe America, because it is a great nation, it's a place. I'm preaching every day to build Harlem as a great place where men are leaders in their homes and leaders in the church, and they can take advantage of this great opportunity. I think there'd be less angst or animus, there'd be less anger, there'd be more of a sense of equality, there would be less begging, there would be less crime. Listen, we could get rid of nearly every police precinct in Chicago and Harlem if black men would go back home and raise their boys under biblical structure. We wouldn't need as many police officers or prisons. We didn't have the number of people in prison going back 70 years ago. There's less than 200,000 men in prison. Now you got more than 2 million. So I think that the argument ought to be for race discussion, that black people need to turn around and say, what can I do for America, rather than what can America do for me?
Wow. That's turning on the John F. Kennedy the quote.
There
yeah,
you go.
Yeah, I'm half English and half Irish, and I often say that my English ancestors had every right to be alarmed at the mass arrival of my Irish ancestors. And you know, we're born into this world, and we can't create history, but we can try to understand it. I really appreciate you coming on, and I appreciate the things you said. Just in the one last question, so. You know, you've lived through an era of segregation and forced integration. What do you think would be most natural? Like, if things were just to go naturally and fortuitously, how much self segregation? How much interaction would there be?
Well, you know, I'm here in Harlem. And I believe it's the capital of black people. I don't mean to put forth a segregationist ideology or philosophy, but I believe that black people ought to be able to manage, live in Harlem and have it as their utopia, and then white folk can live in Beverly Hills and do what the hell they want to do. That's not necessarily a segregationist ideology, but it's more of a social structure, and I'm working every day. People might want to refer to me as a racist. I'm not. I believe the indigenous people, who are primarily black people, ought to have Harlem. Mm. And it ought to be a place where black people represent America in its finest tradition with a major black voice. Whether that's racist or not, I think, oh, let me not leave out God. They ought to represent the Bible and the Word of God as well. Mm-hmm. And I'm appalled that so many white people have moved up here. I found myself doing something the other day that I thought I would never do, and I don't want to do. But I'm angry that so many white people have moved up here in the black community, and they've taken over the way they've taken over. Mm-hmm. It has angered me, and I don't like the idea that I'm angry about that, because I don't want to be considered a racist. Mm-hmm. That's not what I want to be considered.
Mm-hmm. None of us do. Well, Reverend Manning, thank you so much for coming on the show. You're welcome back here anytime.
Will you call me back, and I'll come back again?
I will call you back.
All right, I'll be waiting.
Thank you so much.
And I'll be back again tomorrow with another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio.
It's happening, ladies and gentlemen. We here at RBN are working with Front Sight Firearms Training Institute to bring our audience the best in combat, tactical, and defensive firearms training. Whether you're a private citizen who is new to firearms, or you have a concealed weapon permit, and want a level of training that surpasses what you've received from your local gun range, Front Sight provides priceless education and skills taught by seasoned law enforcement, military, and private citizen instructors to levels that far exceed law enforcement and military standard. With nearly a million responsible citizens trained from every town, city, and state from across the United States, Front Sight has bolstered the Patriot movement to a whole new level. Contact Dan Sutterfield by phone at 573-762-2356 or 573-465-2356 or shoot him an email at domedan, D-O-M-E-D-A-N, at hotmail.com. This is a limited time opportunity. Don't miss it.
You're listening to the Republic Broadcasting Network, because you can handle the truth.